related litigation, particularly on the eve of and the aftermath of elections, and those suits are threatening to and frequently having a significant effect on the outcomes of elections. With us here today to talk about the surge in election litigation, what it portends, and what we expect of it in the future, are three very well-experienced panelists in this area. The first panelist who will be speaking is James Bopp, who I think you've all met on the previous panel. Suffice it to say, he has been involved in some of the most significant election-related litigation that I can think of in the last 10, 15, 20 years, and continues to be involved in more cases than I can count. The most notable ones from the perspective of those of us who deal with campaign finance are obviously cases like McConnell versus FEC, Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, Wisconsin Right to Life, all of those cases in which Jim was typically the lead counsel, I think, in all of those that I've mentioned. And if not the lead counsel, he has certainly been involved in all the other major cases that have come up before the Supreme Court. I could go on, but I think you've already met him, so I'll stop there. Also with us today, Mr. John Fund of the Wall Street Journal. Those of you who know Mr. Fund obviously know that he is the author of two books dealing with election law, one called Stealing Elections, How Voter Fraud Threatens Our Democracy, and the other called Cleaning House, America's Campaign for Term Limits. In addition to that, he has been with the Wall Street Journal for coming up on two decades now, if I'm correct. Is a frequent commentator on Fox News and CNBC, and a frequent columnist in any number of venues. Finally, with us today is Mr. Adam Bonin. Mr. Bonin is the chairman of the board of directors of the Netroots Nation, who I think many of you may notice if you peruse the web at all. You see they're quite active. He's also a member of Cozen O'Connor in Philadelphia, where his practice involves, among other things, considerable amount of election-related litigation, including litigation dealing with the interaction with election law and the web, or the net, representing bloggers before the FEC and before a variety of courts. He is also chairman of the Philadelphia Lawyers Chapter of the American Constitution Society, focusing on all sorts of constitutional issues, which is what I understand he is quite good at. I will let them speak for themselves after this. So I just want to thank you, and we'll start with Mr. Bopp.
Thank you very much. Of course, the name of this panel is Election by Litigation. Now, what I think I would mean by that phrase would be the manipulation of election outcomes through litigation. And an earlier panelist in the first panel explained four principles for election laws that he considered, and I would agree, are the principles that we should adhere to in terms of to have fair elections. And one of those principles was uniformity. And that is that we do not have different rules for different voters, different rules for different candidates, that the rules are uniform. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore announced that principle as a matter of constitutional law. And that is, that sounds in equal protection. That is that it would be if states maintain a system or implemented a system in which voters or candidates were treated differently, had different legal standards applied to their conduct, that would deny equal protection of the law. And I agree with that principle. And during the Bush v. Gore litigation, represented voters in Florida who were subject to a different standard on how their votes would be counted than were being employed in the Democrat counties where the Democrats had asked for a manual recount. I think, is a very important principle. Now, the problem is that litigation tends to almost inherently violate that principle. And I'm going to go through a series of cases where I believe that principle has been violated and to the partisan advantage of particular people. And now, no one would mistaken me for a Democrat, so It is true that the examples I'm about to give involve efforts by the Democrat Party to systematically disenfranchise voters. And frankly, there are 10 that just came to mind the other day as I was thinking about this. They involve examples before elections, during elections, and after elections. So there's no litigation-free zone here, but there's always an opportunity to manipulate the rules to litigation to advantage one candidate over another, or advantage certain voters over another. Now, we mentioned in the other panel about threatened litigation. I think that's a way of manipulating the campaign finance system. But here I'm talking about actual, real-life lawsuits. Well, you could start, if you wish, in 2002 with the Torricelli race, where Senator Torricelli became a discredited and losing candidate in New Jersey. And but the problem was that the time period for filling a vacancy had expired when the Democrats convinced him to resign, creating the vacancy. The deadlines were 51 and 48 days prior to the election, and those had passed when he resigned. Now, if you were a Republican in New Jersey and this happened to you, I mean, who would have thought to litigate the question? In fact, even post 2002, there have been situations where this has occurred among Republican candidates, and they did not fill the vacancy. But no. The lawsuit was brought to the New Jersey Supreme Court, who waived these deadlines. Now, and the replacement for Torricelli then went on the ballot. Unquestionable situation of where the rules were changed to benefit a particular party. Or we could go to the 2000 election in Florida. We could go to the this year's election in the state of Washington, where Dino Rossi is running as the Republican against the incumbent Democrat governor. They have an open primary system where you identify your party affiliation on the ballot, and the first round is open to everybody, no matter what party you're affiliated with. Well, several months ago, Dino Rossi filed his papers, and he indicated that his party affiliation was the GOP. We get to this month, and the Democrat Party filed suit to hold that any ballots that were cast for Dino Rossi, which indicated that he was with the GOP, should be invalidated. Well, it just so happens all the military ballots have gone out as a matter of law, required by federal law. Many of the absentee ballots had gone out. I mean, there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of votes at stake in this technical question. Now, obviously, this has nothing to do with the voter's eligibility or anything else. It has to do with his identification. And the district court judge in King County, the state court judge, ruled that that the state law does not require a particular designation of your party, and that this was sufficient to identify him as a Republican. But if that would have succeeded, we'd have had one rule for one candidate, one rule for another candidate, and brought at a time, not surprisingly, at a time in which military voters would have been nearly universally disenfranchised. And for a partisan purpose, everyone knows that the majority of military voters vote Republican. Or we go to the state of Ohio. The Republican Party sends out the Republican Party or the McCain campaign, I don't remember, sent out a million absentee ballot applications to, no doubt, Republican voters to return them in order to get applications, in order to return those, and then you get your ballot sent out. There's a little box, and this was mentioned in the first panel. There's this little box that you need to check, or at least the form would suggest you need to check, that says you're qualified to vote and requested an absentee, and they wanted all those ballots thrown out. a hyper-technical interpretation of the law that ultimately the Ohio Supreme Court rejected. But even at the time the suit was brought, 3,500 voters who are absolutely entitled to vote, 100% entitled under the law, because they didn't check this little box on the little form, would have been thrown out. Again, partisan litigation for partisan effect. Or you could talk about the 2002 litigation in my own town over state representative in District 46. We have a candidate who moves out of the district under our law. The Republican Party, can fill that vacancy. But then the Democrats sued over the issue of whether or not he had really changed his residency. And here, ultimately, the Republicans won. I represented them in that case. We won. And the replacement person was put on the ballot. But in the meantime, there were absentees and confined voting and in-person voting that occurred. And of course, with the wrong name on it. The person that was not ultimately on the general election ballot, none of those votes were counted. If the replacement Republican would have been on those ballots, he would have won. He lost by a few votes. Again, just the process of litigation, you win at the end, but things happen during the election that you get a partisan advantage as a result of it. Then you can look during the election, literally on election day. And this involves poll closing hours. This began in 2000 in Missouri. It went to Arkansas in 2002. It went to Ohio in 2004. Went to Indiana, I think also in 2004. And is now going, just expected, standard operating procedure. In any given locality, there will be problems with getting the polls open. People die, people get automobile accidents, people sleep in. The janitor doesn't show up on time to open the door. We're talking about human beings and human activity, and that's why they have this, 12, 14, 16 hours to file your ballot. It is one reason, so that if you're there at 6 a.m. and it's not open, that doesn't mean you can't vote. That's going to happen in large metropolitan cities. You can absolutely guarantee it. So what has been the reaction? Lawsuits to keep the polls open. Not on the whole state. Not in these rural localities or suburban areas where you got all these Republicans. But in Indianapolis, in Cleveland, in St. Louis, in Kansas City. So all you people out there in these suburban and rural areas, you got one time where your polls close, and these people in these urban areas, they get a lot more time to cast their vote. Partisan changing of the rules for partisan effect. Or how about after the election? Well, you could start with Florida in 2002. Where were the recounts called for? Was it statewide? No. It was three, four Democrat counties. They were going to go mining for votes in these Democrat counties. So in my view, the court never reached this, but I think that violates the idea of uniformity. Because if you're manually recounting votes in some, there's no question, in my view, I've done recounts, and I've done them with punch cards and all this, you can mine for votes. Now, particularly if you change the standard. Now, that was ultimately what the Supreme Court said was unconstitutional, and that is that there was one standard for all these other counties, and then in Palm Beach and Dade and Broward, they changed the standards not only from what they had originally, but they were progressively changing the standards as they proceeded to manually recount day to day. It makes you're not being treated the same. If your dimple is counted in Broward County, but your dimple is not counted in Orange County. So that was the violation of the idea of uniformity. And of course, that was exactly what the whole effort was about, and that is mining for votes in order to get the job done. Also in Florida, that the the initial problem, which resulted in the first Florida decision, was the deadline for manual recounts. There was a deadline, and to get that job done. And because things follow, you know, boom, in terms of what happens as a result of elections. So the Florida Supreme Court, as a result of the request of candidate Gore, waived the deadline. Now, you know, think of how many other candidates, certainly before, perhaps after, have been adversely affected by that deadline. And who would have thought to sue to say that I have a right to have a manual recount after the deadline? Who would have thought to do that? Now, that decision was unanimous on the 100% Democrat Florida Supreme Court. But the second decision was not. It was 4-3. And that's where half the Democrats on the Florida Supreme Court got off the train. And that is when the Florida Supreme Court ordered a recount without standards to be completed and counted in these Democrat counties in Florida. And in fact, you've got to look at the oral argument. The attorney for Gore came up there with a plan, and it said, now, if you order this, we do this, then that's what we want. And, of course, is what would lead to Gore's victory. That's exactly what the Florida Supreme Court ordered. That was the most partisan, New Jersey Supreme Court maybe had an argument. Florida Supreme Court has got to have been the most partisan decision in American history, which is why the U.S. Supreme Court stopped it. They could not be trusted, the Florida Supreme Court, to administer this election. Could not be trusted to do that. And I think that was the right decision. It was you could go to more afters. You could also go to this case, which is currently pending in the Indiana Court of Appeals. Indiana has a statute that implements the Hatch Act. And it provides a remedy under state law if you're hatched. Okay? And that is that you're disqualified from assuming or being a candidate for office. Isn't that interesting how that's stated? It says that you're disqualified for being a candidate. So that means that if you're hatched in Indiana, you can sue and say you're disqualified from being on the ballot. And that gives, of course, the political party an opportunity to replace the person who's now been disqualified because he's hatched. All right. Well, the Mayor Burke of Terre Haute waited until after the election and surprisingly lost to the Republican. And then he brings suit and says, well, he was hatched, so therefore he's disqualified, and therefore I get another term, 4 years in office, despite the results of the election. Well, the Indiana Court of Appeals, the trial court, denied that relief, saying it's prospective in nature. We'll see if the Indiana Court of Appeals agrees. And if they do, they will have manipulated the rules for a partisan political outcome. The result would be, of the decision, it would be a manipulation urged by the Democrat mayor of a partisan political effect of that particular provision. Now, you know, I'm not one to say you shouldn't sue. Yeah, I do on occasion sue, and but campaign finance, I think, is a different order, and there are different considerations. In campaign finance, if you can strike down prohibition, it benefits everybody. There's no the First Amendment applies only to NARAL. I mean, the National Right to Life, not NARAL. Okay, if a law is invalidated, and I always pursue them, wanting them to be invalidated for everyone, then everyone can participate. So you continue with uniformity. You had uniform prohibition, now you have uniform freedom. This doesn't work that way. And of course, the same, not all the same constitutional interests are involved. And here, uniformity, I think, is essential to preventing partisan manipulation. And so people have figured that out. There's armies of lawyers funded by the tobacco settlement who have a huge interest in the presentation, the preservation of power by the Democrats, because Republicans want to do tort reform, and Democrat trial lawyers don't want them to, who are very skilled at litigation, who can be very successful, who have unlimited resources, and we have just seen way too much of this. And I don't know, I'm not saying that I know exactly the problem, because it can be, I mean, the solution, because it can be manipulated before, during, and after. But we need some solution needs to be found in order to prevent what could ultimately lead to just a system of, well, let's just cancel the elections, let the lawyers and the judges decide.
Thank you, Jim. Next up will be Bob.
It's a pleasure to be here. I suspect that many of you are either readers or subscribers to the Wall Street Journal, so the least I could do is come and thank you for helping me pay my salary, which you all do. I'm afraid that we may have crossed a Rubicon, to use an allusion from ancient literature, in the same way that the nomination of Robert Bork in 1987 crossed a Rubicon on how we handled Supreme Court nominations. It's pretty clear, looking back, that nominations before that date were handled in one fashion, more or less. Nominations after that date, with a couple of exceptions, were handled differently. And I just fear that the Florida recount and dispute in 2000 represented a crossing of the Rubicon, how we handle close presidential elections. In summary, both presidential candidates now have to presume that they don't just have to win by margin of victory, they have to win by something beyond the margin of litigation. And that will perhaps apply to this election as well, depending on how close it is. I predict, by the way, things are going to tighten. The Obama campaign privately believes that. The McCain campaign fervently hopes that. with or with not without any evidence. In Florida, we had a combination of a very sloppy election system in some counties, somewhat ambiguous state laws, an interesting Florida Supreme Court, and the rest of the state government in Republican hands. So you had a peculiar set of chess pieces going back and forth. If you just had changed one or two of them, you might have had an entirely different outcome. I think that's clear. It was an unusual set of circumstances in Florida. Change one piece, we might have a different president today. For some of you, that would be a good thing. For some of you, that might be an ambiguous thing. But the principle, but the principle remains that these are important stakes when you're dealing with a presidential election. Luckily, the founding fathers, when they created the Electoral College, actually, I think, contained this problem somewhat. If the election had been very close, and even was close nationally, and you had no electoral college, imagine what the counts in all 50 states would have been like. That's what we would have ended up with. And at least under the electoral college, you can try to contain it to one, two, three, or four states, because it's unlikely that all of those states are going to be close. Now, how have we progressed since Florida 2000? We have lots of new electronic voting machines, which we tried out in 2002, in 2004, and 2006. They were found wanting or unpopular for various reasons. And now we've gone back to where 55% of the people are using the newspaper ballots, mostly optical scan machine ballots again. So we've gone from one extreme through an electronic voting machine period, and now back largely to optical scan ballots. Electronic voting machines that are new and better and perhaps carry a paper trail may be in our future, but not for this election. I think the one progress we've made is that hanging chads are pretty much a thing of the past. Thank goodness. People ask me how I got interested in the issue of election law and voter fraud. It was as a college student that, as a part of a class project, I watched a recount procedure in California where I was growing up. and it was a hanging chad election, and I literally saw with my own eyes people cheating in the recount. And people always ask me, why did you report this to the authorities? And I always say, well, I might have, except it was the authorities who were doing it. The conditions, though, in Florida are a little better. Florida's probably, given their unhappy experience, a little less likely to fall into the clutches of this trap. Other states, frankly, have made very little progress, only no modest progress, or in some cases, I think, have reverted backwards. Washington State has had two close elections now that took months to decide. In 2000, they had a Senate race between Slate Gorton and Maria Cantwell that took over 40 days to decide because of the recounts, largely predicated on the fact that they were all these paper ballots. They had vote-by-mail elections in Washington State. At that time, something like 60% of the votes were coming in by mail, a little less than Oregon's 100%, but still significant. It took 40 days to decide that election. You would have known a lot more about that recount, except it happened at the same time as the Florida Bush v. Gore recount, but that recount was deciding the control of the United States Senate. Remember, the Senate was 50-50 that year. If it had gone a different direction in that Senate race, it would have been 51-49. So that shows you how important these recounts and litigation can be. Then 4 years later, the governor's race, which is infamous, the 133 vote margin after three recounts, and during the final manual recount, new ballots, new batches of ballots were found 16 separate times in King County, which led some people to declare Kiev County, because that was the same year of the Ukrainian election that resulted in the Orange Revolution. And that created a lot of suspicion. Ultimately, a judge found there was insufficient evidence to take the unprecedented step of calling a new election, but they certainly found that there had been many irregularities, more felons, more dead people, more suspect categories of voters had cast ballots in that election than clearly the margin of the 133 votes. And that bitterness and lack of legitimacy in the part of parts of the electorate lingers to this day, just as the bitterness and lack of legitimacy that some people felt about the Bush v. Gore election lingered to this day. It did have consequences on how people governed and how people were viewed as governing. So these are non-trivial issues. The issues, the wounds, do not go away just with the inauguration of whoever is declared the winner. The problem that we saw in Washington State was, I think, that you couldn't tell where the incompetence ended and the fraud might have begun. I think that's a fair statement of many of these disputes. Many people have dark suspicions about human nature. I share some of those, and that those suspicions are justified often on both sides of the aisle. But it's often the case that you have a sloppy election system with vague interpretations of poorly drafted rules that allow a lot of play in the joints, that allow a lot of games to be played in recounts or in the subsequent court cases that result from them. And that ambiguity is, I think, the first step to perhaps tightening up the culture of election by litigation. We need to take a searching examination of our election laws as much as we possibly can before the next midterm and the next presidential election, and try to have some agreement where we're not in the full heat of partisan battle to decide where can this be tightened up so there is less ambiguity, less vagueness, less play in the joints, and in some cases, less discretion on the part of election officials. And perhaps in some cases, as King County voters decided overwhelmingly to change the way that election official is selected. Part of the suspicion in King County, the 2004 governor's race, was of 58 counties in Washington, there was only one where the top election official was appointed by a partisan county executive, King County. The other 57 had an elected official as the top recorder of votes. That raised suspicions, so much so that when King County voters had to decide on whether or not they should go to the system used by the other 57 counties, 71% of them voted to change the system. This is in a county where George Bush won only 32% of the vote in 2000. So clearly this was a bipartisan decision. So first we should look at the election rules. As much agreement as possibly can be done before the election Nate's foresaw some of this litigation. Because, I'll be very blunt with you, right now, with the election laws in place and the ambiguities in place, if you compare our election conditions to that of a that would apply in a forest at the end of a long, dry summer where there's lots of tinder brush and dry grasses that could lead to a fire, we are in just as much danger of another forest fire in our election contest this year, except a lot more people have matches. They're called lawyers. Now, I know I'm addressing primarily a group of lawyers. I have nothing against lawyers. I think they perform very useful functions in society. But I note that the Obama campaign is about 9,000 volunteer lawyers. The McCain campaign is about 5,000 volunteer lawyers. I submit to you that an election of this consequence, 14,000 lawyers watching and planning for perhaps litigation, may not be a good thing. 14,000 lawyers. I was recently in Oregon last week, and I note again some of the ambiguities that are there. Oregon has 100% male voting. Their system is touted as being very effective, but I suspect that there's some problems. For one thing, there's a simple problem of this. You want to vote on election day in Oregon. You haven't mailed in your ballot. My sister lives in Oregon. She lives in Beaverton. If you wake up on election morning and you haven't voted, you don't have any choice. Unless you drive to the county clerk or depositary, which can be miles away, you can't vote on election day. I think this creates with it something. Even though the Ninth Circuit has ruled the other way in a three-judge panel, I think this, in the future, creates a potential area of litigation. At what point in this country, when the statutes of this country, as passed by Congress, call for a uniform election day, at what point do we have actually an election month rather than election day? We had people casting votes in this election for president before the first presidential debate was held. You have now people casting votes throughout the process as information is compiled by voters and processed by voters at different points. Candidates literally have to plan different campaigns for each week depending on which batch of voters have applied for absentee ballot applications. I question in the future whether or not we're going to think this kind of convenience fast food voting, which is popular, don't get me wrong, is necessarily a good thing for our democracy. Because we may end up with election month on both ends in the future in a close race. Election month before the election when we vote absentee, and 30% of the country is scheduled to vote absentee early this year. Election day, when perhaps half the people vote, and election month where we litigate how the people voted in election month prior to the election. In other words, 2 months of an election. You think our presidential campaign was long. Wait till you get to the two-month election process in every close race. I do this for a living. I'm already exhausted. I don't know about you. So all these problems in Washington State, by the way, that took place, what was the response of the legislature? They went from 60% mail-in voting to 100% mail-in voting. Washington State is now basically 100% mail-in voting. Precisely the conditions that led to the recounts and disputes for 40 days didn't faze the legislature one bit. They decided to double down, and now it's 100% mail-in voting. Their last two close elections took 40 days to resolve because they were paper ballots and mail-in ballots. Very difficult to count, very easy to litigate. Very easy to litigate on a paper ballot. So they're going to set themselves up for perhaps another spin of the Russian roulette wheel. Here's the third element, and I'll conclude with this, of potential litigation. We all know about HAVA. And HAVA is the Help America Vote Act. A central provision of it was the federal mandate on provisional ballots. In theory, I support this. Believe me, I've seen enough election officials and their incompetence or overburdened work schedules, registrations fall through the cracks. HAVA basically says, if you show up anywhere in this country, presumably in most states in the precinct where you have a residence and are said to have registered, you have to be given a provisional ballot if your name is not on the registration list. This led to some litigation in 2004, especially in Ohio, with the Sixth Circuit decision. There's going to be far more litigation on that this year. Throughout the country, we have seen tremendous spurts in registrations. Tremendous spurts. It's a good thing. But many of these volunteer groups have a tendency or a habit of dumping registrations on election officials on the last possible day for the registration cutoff, which in most cases was earlier this week, Monday. I can guarantee you some registrations are going to fall through the cracks. Some people that should have been registered won't be registered on the list. Some people who shouldn't have been registered, and believe me, regarding at least some registrations from the group ACORN, which I'm happy to discuss in question and answers, there are some suspect registrations. And there are some other people who often, political parties both often turn in registrations that are inaccurate on both sides. There's some people on the list who won't necessarily be eligible. And there's some people who may just show up and say they're registered. They'll all be given a provisional ballot. All of them. Well, if this election is close, if, let's say, all hinges on the state of Pennsylvania, and Obama's ahead by 20,000 votes, or McCain's ahead by 20,000 votes, but over here on the side, in various county offices, there are 100,000 provisional votes. Nobody knows how many of those are valid. The national percentage is about 70% end up being valid. Some states it's as low as 40. Some states it's as high as 80 or 90. Litigation is almost guaranteed. If you have a 20,000 vote margin on 100,000 absentee provisional ballots, you're going to litigate. Because one side will say count every vote, and the other side will say the rule of law. And there'll be various interpretations in between. And I suspect that's not going to be good for our country, because in conclusion, I saw the bitterness in 2000. Today, polls show 40% of Americans, 40% of Americans, believe there is substantial corruption of our election process. They either believe 23% of the country believes there's substantial voter fraud, 17% of this country believes there's substantial voter intimidation and suppression. And you can find examples of both. That's 40% of the country that is fundamentally toxic in its attitude towards the credibility of our election system. In 2000, we were at peace, and consumer confidence hit the all-time high in modern history the day of that election. It was a good time to have a vicious, bitter, protracted election dispute in this country if you're going to have one. Today, we have international crises all around the world. Iran, North Korea, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, you name them. We also have, I'm sure as you open up your 401k statements this week, we also have a financial crisis. And many of you are stressed and strained in that way, and we also have a credit crunch. This is not a good time to have a protracted election battle. Because I believe, with all sincerity, that the next president of the United States needs to take office with full credibility and legitimacy of that office, and to represent all Americans, and for people to have confidence in those results. That's why the stakes here are much more important than even they were in 2000. We need a president, maybe not that we have voted for, but a president we believe is actually the president, and a president whom we think will take office with full legitimacy. If we don't get that, There is nothing that says we're going to get through the next crisis easily. We need all hands on deck. That is why I hope we have a conversation about how to fight this election and how to fight election litigation with perhaps not the Marcus of Queensbury rules, but perhaps with some restraint, because ultimately we're all Americans and we all want our democracy to function. Thank you.
Our final speaker will be Mr. Bone.
Okay, I'm going to stay seated at this point. It is really a pleasure to be here and to be speaking along with such distinguished co-panelists. I also want to give a special thanks to the Federalist Society. I noted during our lunch service that you were offering Newman's Own Salad Dressing as the condiment for the salads, and on behalf of all the progressive organizations that you're supporting for your condiment choice today, I thank you. I should also note that as Jim didn't make explicit, but I feel like I should, that I represent a lot of different clients in election law, some of whom are appalled by my very being here today, and I want to be clear that I speak on behalf of none of them today. I'm barely speaking on my own behalf. So, back in July, I was riding on the ferry that takes you across Cape Cod Bay from Provincetown to Boston. And I found myself seated next to a woman in her mid-50s, and she mentioned that she had just started a blog. Now, I need to throw in a caveat here. I am a blogger. I write for the front page of Daily Kos. I have a pop culture blog to which I contribute, and I represent bloggers all the time in various legal matters. But I asked this woman a question that I came to regret, and I want you all to seriously consider if this question ever occurs to you to ask of somebody. Because I asked her, oh, really, what do you blog about? And her answer was, I'm compiling evidence on how the Obama folks stole the election from Hillary. And she pulled out this, you know, 3-inch-high stack of documents that she had in her bag, which she claimed demonstrated the theft of thousands of votes in Texas alone from the caucuses. And over the remaining 75 minutes, on this not big enough boat, I and my fellow passengers were subjected to a peroration on the evils of the caucus system, on voter fraud, things like this. If you remember from the film A Beautiful Mind, what John Nash had gone on in his garage, or if you saw Zodiac and what Robert Highsmith had going on in trying to track down San Francisco's serial killer, you have some idea of what was going on here. And the way, you know, the only way you deal with this is the way that I deal with my 5-year-old daughter Lucy when she goes on in a tantrum. You just have to let the person go and go and go and not escalate until that person decides that it's nap time. There is no point in escalating the confrontation. I want to mention that I mentioned this story for 3 reasons. First, because I don't want you to have the misimpression from John that Republicans are the only people who are concerned with protecting the integrity of the ballot. Secondly, because I don't want you to have the misimpression that there are only sane people who are involved in these issues. But third and most importantly, well, not most importantly, because I want to be clear, and many of the other people who are involved in this should know this, is that I still have qualms about the whole deregulated blogosphere thing based on incidents like this. but over to what John and Jim said, I have surprisingly little disagreement with most of what John said. A little bit more with Jim on some of the details, but okay, the Torricelli race, yeah, of course. Yeah. but the truth is that I don't think it's as much about needing to standardize the laws as it is needing to standardize the people. And I think the reason why there's so much election-generated litigation, or at least the way that we can reduce some of it, is that we don't trust those who administer elections to do it right. Whether it's Democrats in 2004 in Ohio who didn't trust Secretary of State Ken Blackwell when he wasn't placing enough polling places in minority precincts, or Republicans in Ohio who are upset now by Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner in her efforts to open up and clarify the so-called magic window, a week during which one could register to vote and vote at the same time. Look, part of the problem with 2004, in addition to questions about the composition of the Florida Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court, is that you had the co-chair of Bush's state election committee serving as Florida Secretary of State. So that even if she got every single decision right as a matter of law, half the country wasn't going to trust anything that came out of her office. And on that, I do want to note as a sidebar, if you haven't yet seen HBO's movie Recount about the Florida 2000 election, do so. It is a movie that does for election lawyers what Raiders of the Lost Ark does for archaeologists. It is the one movie that makes what we do look cool and interesting, and I encourage you to see that. There was a poll in today's Washington Post from Ohio. There are only 33% of Ohio voters who are confident that all the votes will be counted accurately. That is appalling. That is not something, and John is absolutely right about it, that is not something that we as a democracy can tolerate. You know, in times like this, in calm times, you know, voters need to be assured that their votes are, that their votes are counted and that things are done accurately. So here's the problem. At present, 38 of the 50 secretaries of state or secretaries of the Commonwealth in America who administer elections are elected officials. 9 of them are appointed by governors. 3 of them are selected by state legislatures. If we were to shift to nonpartisan systems in each state, and mind you, I generally don't believe in this whole nonpartisan bipartisan thing. I think that too often it's being used as a rhetorical shield to cover whatever you feel like defending that day. But in this case, if we had election officials who were appointed through some kind of nonpartisan process, Professor Rick Hassan at Loyola Law School suggests that somebody, nominated by a governor but with 75% or 2/3 approval by state legislatures, that could restore some more faith that these decisions are being done solely with an eye towards a faithful administration of the laws and not towards partisan ends. But to be sure, nothing is going to get rid of election litigation. The stakes are extremely high. Lawyers, like everybody else, like winning. And there's nothing you can do to get rid of all of it. And one of the places where I would want to shift the focus and get people thinking about election-related litigation is by turning away from looking at fraud allegedly committed by voters to looking at fraud allegedly committed to voters. Last week, and you'll see this towards the back of your packets, flyers were placed anonymously under car windshield wipers in minority sections of my hometown, Philadelphia, insisting that, quote, on the day of the election, there will be undercover officers to execute warrants, end quote, based on those who come out to vote, and that anybody who had, quote, unquote, outstanding warrants or traffic offenses had better clear things up, because election day was the one day that they were going to have to use their real identities. The flyers also asserted that at polling places there were going to be police cars with plate identification computers that would put the boot on it, the parts of any scofflaws. This is a tried and true voter intimidation tactic. In Baltimore in 2002, the unsigned flyers said, urgent notice, come to vote, but before you should come to vote, be sure you pay your parking tickets, motor vehicle tickets, overdue rent, and those warrants. In Philadelphia, going back to 2003, you had black cars circling minority neighborhoods with official-looking signatures that looked like the DEA emblem, that looked like the FBI emblem, that were dispatched to minority neighborhoods. And in a post-election survey of 1,000 African-American voters, 7% said that they had encountered these efforts and seen these cars circling around and with the people inside asking people to show their identification. And the final example I will point to, just because it still appalls me, is that during Louisiana's 2002 runoff election, which ended up reelecting Senator Mary Landrieu, flyers were distributed in black public housing complexes in New Orleans, reading in part, quote, vote, bad weather, no problem. If the weather is uncomfortable on election day, Saturday, December 7th, remember you can wait and cast your ballot on Tuesday, December 10th. So, by the way, you couldn't. Just to be clear, what are we to do about this? There's a bill before Congress right now. It's called the Deceptive Practices in Voter Intimidation Prevention Act. I can call it a bipartisan bill because Tom Coburn is a co-sponsor of it, along with about 20 Democrats. By way of full disclosure, my former election law professor is the lead sponsor of it. He's that guy who's been in the news, who you're going to be seeing on TV tonight, and certainly not speaking on his behalf. And this law would make it a crime for anybody to, within 60 days before a federal election, lie about the time, place, or manner of the election, lie about voter eligibility, whether it's an individual's eligibility or general qualifications to vote, lie about the party affiliation of someone running in a primary. This is to counteract what was going on in Maryland in 2006, where there were phony sample ballots being distributed claiming that the Republican nominee for Governor Michael Steele was in fact a Democrat and part of the endorsed Democratic slate, or again, the last thing, lie about endorsement by any persons or candidates. One of the things that they did in this bill as it went through committee is that they had stripped out a private right of action which had been within the bill, and instead the way it works is that this is for the DOJ to act upon. And if the DOJ doesn't act, you're allowed to basically petition a court for a mandamus to try to get them to do so. It is something that is worth considering. I know that there were concerns expressed by some of the Republican senators on the bill as to separation of powers issues in terms of how citizens could encourage DOJ to do something. But these are principles that should be enshrined in law somehow. Second thing that is worth considering, and this is more of a general thing than an election law thing, is that Jim was right when he said before, high-powered D.C. election lawyers cost a lot of money. Us colleagues, out in the states like Philadelphia and Indiana cost a little bit less, but it still costs a lot of money. But what we see, both in local elections in Philadelphia, and I'm pretty sure on the Senate and House levels, is these things can ring up enormous legal bills. And we have a client at my firm, Congressman Robert Brady, who had run for mayor last year for the Democratic nomination. His nomination petitions were challenged by a fellow Democrat, Tom Knox, a multimillionaire who was seeking the office, and who had unlimited funds to dedicate to trying to get him knocked off the ballot. Brady succeeded at every level of the litigation. There was no question his petitions were valid, his financial disclosures were valid, but still he had to fight this through Court of Common Pleas, Commonwealth Court, Supreme Court, Commonwealth Court again. These things are tough to pay for if you're a candidate under contribution limits. It would be nice to see a parallel to what we have on the presidential level with the general election legal and accounting funds, so-called GLAC funds, so that candidates could raise additional funds beyond the standard contribution limits for the purposes of ensuring their compliance with the law and to make sure that lawyers get paid. All in favor of lawyers getting paid. And finally, I need to talk about a form of election litigation that's near and dear to my heart, and that is identity theft as practiced through petition fraud. You will see in your packets the entirety of the petitions that were submitted by Tommy Blackwell, who is the scion of a powerful political family in Philadelphia, in his efforts to be reelected as state representative. Mind you, he needed 300 ballot signatures, and he submitted about 750 of them. And if you look through these pages, you will see just what an atrocious job that they did. Every single registered Democrat on various blocks, straight down the page, same handwriting, no question obvious. They didn't even do what we call in Philadelphia kitchen table fraud. And a kitchen table fraud is you take that voter list and you put four people around the table, so at least you've got four different signatures, alternating on the page, to make it a little bit more difficult to track these people. Long story short, and the long story, if we have time for it, involves some admissions of Vicodin abuse on the stand. That it's one of my favorite stories to tell, but it's a little bit of a distraction here. He got kicked off the ballot. That wasn't it, because Blackwell mounted a write-in campaign by having stamps printed. And this is the exact thing that they had. They were individual stamps that were printed that had his name on the back of it, came with stamp pads. And the idea was, to vote for him as a write-in, you could just stamp it, stick it on, it's there, no question, right name, it'll be counted. The problem was that he put about the same amount of effort and thoughtfulness into his write-in campaign as he did into the petition fraud, which is to say, rather than have campaign workers outside each polling place to approach voters, to explain to them, if you want to vote for Tommy and keep your incumbent in office, this is how you have to do it. Instead, what they did on election day was walk into the polling places, walk up to the election judges, and say, here's these packets. Why don't you hand them to people on their way? The judges, thank goodness, the local election judges, these more or less volunteer people, and all, long-time Democrats, had the same reaction you guys did. Because, and you know, and so I found, you know, this packet. Let's just say I determined that it was abandoned property. And at first, because literally, they were just sitting outside the polling places with nobody watching them and handing them out. There are a lot of us who are really invested in trying to win litigation, and we're going to fight like hell for any perceived advantage that's out there. There are fewer people out there like those election judges, people who just want to enforce and implement the law regardless of who's helped and who's hurt by it. These are the people who we need to have running elections, not partisan officials. We need to restore the public faith, and we need to have confidence that come the end of the day on November 4th, 2008, that the person who they say was elected is the person who in fact won the most votes. Thanks.
Thank you very much. We still have about half an hour left for questions and answers. I'll take the moderator's privilege and start with a question from the panel, then we'll open it up to anybody else who wants to ask questions. I guess my two-part question is as follows. Given the closeness of certain races, particularly the ones that spawn litigation, and the number of votes being cast, are many of these races these days just not even within the margin of error, so that the answer is, as a statistical matter, they're a tie? And if that's the case, is there some better way of deciding who won than to pretend that, you know, the sub-margin of error determination actually means anything? And the second question related to that is it possible that litigation is a good thing in this context, because it imposes discipline? Knowing that you're likely to get sued, knowing that your predecessors have been sued, imposes a little bit of defensive honesty. So all three of those.
The one thing that I would say to that is, I think transparency is a good thing. And I think that the internet allows the opportunity for more transparency than we've ever had in the past. There was a contested election for Pennsylvania State Senate in 2006 out in the Philadelphia suburbs that was decided on a variety of manual recounts. And I remember one of the things that happened during that race is that the Philadelphia Inquirer posted on its website, you know, PDFs of, you know, 100, you know, like the last 100 disputed, you know, filled in oval ballots, you know, on their website, so that voters could see on each ballot, you know, this is what it looks like, this is how the court ruled. And I think that we need to take advantage of technology like that so that voters have an understanding of where these decisions are coming from. And yeah, I do think that that kind of transparency can impose a greater degree of responsibility on behalf of those who are making these kinds of decisions.
John or Jim?
We used to have very gentlemanly, gentlewomanly ways of handling this. In tied elections, many states flip a coin, or they take a drawing from a hat, something like that. I suspect that we will look back on those days with a certain amount of nostalgia in the future. The concept that I shouldn't sue because somebody else may sue against me probably doesn't work, because politicians have egos, and they tend to believe that by divine right they should win by landslide anyway. Anything is below 100% of the vote is an insult to some of them. I've actually had conversations like that with people. And they don't believe that just because they had a close election this time, they're going to have another close election. So I think that kind of restraint is an interesting exercise of wishful thinking.
I don't think it's a matter of dishonesty. I think our traditional ways of dealing with elections, and that is recounts and contests, were designed to deal with that, and certainly has eliminated many, not all, but many of the ways in which elections were dishonestly manipulated. I'm talking about intentional manipulation of the rules. Often when the rules are crystal clear, no ambiguity, the deadline's passed, sometimes, of course, where ambiguities or hyper-technical interpretations of particular laws are being employed. That's the problem that I see, creating a lack of uniformity in these laws, which resulted in partisan benefits. And, there's a lot of reasons why that happens, but I think that's the problem I would see.
Questions from the audience? Yes, gentlemen.
Jonathan, with the American Legislative Exchange Council, could panel comment on what you think sort of the top couple reforms that could be done at the state level in light of current federal laws to get a address this issue?
Well, the growth industry in this country is absentee voting. And I distinguish absentee voting from early voting, which I think has fewer problems. Early voting is conducted under a controlled environment in the view of election officials. You're going to a county clerk's office, you're going to a school. In some cases, you're even going to a supermarket or a shopping center where election officials are temporarily stationed, and you're casting your ballot early because you think you're going to be out of town. You might have other business, or you simply want the convenience. This is very popular. States from Tennessee to Texas have a large number of early voters. I will note, by the way, that early voting can sometimes have bizarre consequences. Al Gore, in 2000, was told about 10 days before the election that he was in danger of losing his home state of Tennessee, which drove him to a bit of a fit, and he immediately ordered the deployment of vast resources of commercial time and paid labor into the state of Tennessee to make sure he wouldn't lose it. Those were diverted from a state called Florida. It turns out that what they didn't tell Al Gore is, yes, he was in jeopardy in the state of Tennessee, but that 31% of the votes had already been cast, which meant if he'd actually had figured that out, he probably would have realized that a lot of the votes that he was trying to get had already been cast. He wouldn't be replicated. He ended up losing Tennessee narrowly. He ended up losing Florida even more narrowly. So this changes. The shift to early and absentee voting changes the whole dynamics of the campaign. The reason I want to focus on absentee voting is this. This is an area where both parties are deficient. Republican legislatures have often passed voter ID laws. Only a handful that have passed the voter ID laws have passed laws tightening up absentee voting. That's because absentee voting is very popular with constituencies of both parties. And nobody seems to want to touch this third rail of election law. But absentee voting is a serious problem, and it is a bipartisan problem. If you want to find Democrats who have a real problem with absentee voting, I can take you to all the elections where they are very vocal about it. There are Democratic primary elections where the loser claims that there's been fraud or manipulation of the ballot. I can take you to Detroit, I can take you to St. Louis, I can take you to the border counties in Texas where Ciro Rodriguez, the chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, was convinced that he had an election stolen out from under him by the use of absentee ballots in 2004. I can take you to East Chicago, Indiana, where an election was thrown out and the new mayor installed because of absentee ballot fraud. Absentee ballot fraud is used by both parties. It is a serious problem, and it is getting worse because we have more and more absentee ballots. And believe me, there are about 15 different ways to cheat using absentee ballots. There are only about two or three ways to cheat using in-person voting. So that is the area I would focus on.
I mean, I actually share this concern. There is something to be said for the sanctity of the polling place, that the idea of you go into this space and nobody else can see what you're doing in there. I mean, and this was an issue that I was first apprised of back in 1993 when I was in college. We had a special election for the state senate in Philadelphia, and staffers were the Democratic candidate in the race. I shouldn't be talking to Democratic candidate in the race. Had workers going from house to house, primarily in Hispanic neighborhoods, telling people about what they called a new way of voting.
Like a way of performing the Votar.
Where all they had to do was fill out the ballot right there in front of them, and they would bring it to the, put it in the mail for them, and wouldn't that be great? And Pennsylvania has, pretty strict and sound rules about when you're actually supposed to be able to cast absentee ballots, which is, when you know you're not going to be in the county and available to attend your polling place on election day. I mean, this these election results were thrown out by the court because of just how much absentee ballot fraud there was. I mean, if I have a golden rule in terms of is this election reform a good idea or a bad idea, part of the test has to be what would Philadelphia ward leaders do if they had this power? and in this case, the kind of widespread mail-in voting that they had in Washington and Oregon, I would not like to see in Philadelphia.
Anything, Jim?
I agree.
Next question.
Absolutely.
Other questions? Well, then I will, in the back.
Member Bragg, and I work up on the Hill. I have a question particularly for John. Do you not think that one of the best antiseptics for the entire thing, despite our perfection being here, because we're dealing with water once it's over the dam, and I think James does a great job with it when it's there, but a better antiseptic would be the free market thing, that the parties put more people in the voting places, either as workers or watchers. And in a lot of places, the poll workers have to come from a particular district. You've got gerrymandering at the local level, so you've got Democrat districts, Republican districts, the other party can't get in there. But if you have workers from both sides watching out for things, poll watchers in many of the areas, poll watchers that are down there while you're doing the absentee things, it's been my experience since 84, just at the retail level, trying to prevent vote fraud, that about 97% of it can be handled with one question. What are you doing? And make them answer the question on the spot. Because most of the time, it may be some little old lady that, well, we're just hearing the ballots loose, and when the rush comes, we're ready to go. Not knowing someone's going to cheat 60 ballots off or something. But it's been stopped previously. But the antiseptic of getting more people involved, and leave it up to the parties to get them in. Leave it up to the candidates to flush their volunteers in. But enabling those things to be where, if I live in all Republican zone, I can go be an election official in all Democrat zone. Some of these things such as that, so that at least you've got some displays on them, and where you can take your cameras in there and actually make photographs of what's going on.
Oh, that's a form of intimidation.
Yeah,
you
right.
haven't gotten that memo, have you? Would that it were so. I think just as I said, we crossed the Rubicon at the Florida. I think we've also crossed the Rubicon perhaps with election observers. There's now a great deal of suspicion about election observers. I agree many of them are not properly trained. I think if they were more properly trained, there won't be fewer degrees of suspicion. But the Secretary of State in Ohio, during this early voting process, interpreted the rules in such a way that election observers were not allowed in the places where the early voting was done. And, you know, for a period of time, for a week, they were able to register to vote and vote on the same day. This is fraught with peril. Same-day voter registration is going to be, I predict, the first bill passed by the next Congress. It will be the first bill. Just as motor voter was the first bill passed by the Democratic Congress in 1993 when they had a president that would sign it. Same-day voter registration has been rejected by the electorates of Colorado and California by overwhelming majorities. I'm from California. We had a Taco Bell heir put the same-day voter registration initiative on the ballot a couple of years ago, and he spent $25 million on it. The opposition had $1 million. 61% of Californians voted against it because they thought that it was going to be an incentive for fraud, and they were right. If you ever want to read a hair-raising document, you can go on the web and find this. The Milwaukee Police Department earlier this year published a 78-page document detailing how thousands of voters, votes in Milwaukee and the surrounding counties in Wisconsin, were probably stolen in the 2004 presidential election by people using the same-day registration system, especially some people coming over the border from Illinois and being residents for a day. 78 pages, law enforcement document. It was basically dismissed as a partisan document, even though it was by law enforcement officials. It was largely ignored. But it's there. And we can get things even more wrong in this country if we pass same-day voter registration laws. As for the observers, you know, I was in Oregon again last week. Observers in the recounts there have to stand behind a line 40 feet away from the counting tables. There are a lot of laws because election officials, you know, they're overworked and they're underfunded. I mean, let's face it, there's not a politician in this country who really wants wholesale election reform deep in their heart of hearts, because always remember something about incumbent politicians. They got elected by these rules, whatever they are. They must have something good about them because they got elected under them. So there is enormous resistance to wholesale change and reform along the lines you're thinking. I mean, it's like asking chickens to deliver themselves to Colonel Sanders. I mean, it's an interesting proposition, but it rarely happens. There has to be, unfortunately, enormous public resistance or enormous public demand for such a change. I thought that might have happened after Florida in 2000. I was largely wrong. I thought that there might have been more, perhaps, if the 2004 election had been just a little closer, so it would have been within the marginal litigation of Ohio, you might have seen that. We may have that after this election, depending on what the outcome is. But I am fairly skeptical that your idea can be implemented on a national basis, because there's a lot more resistance to election observers in the world than there used to be.
Doesn't relate to the question. I'd like to comment on their two proposals for how to advance the ball on this. And, you know, I think there's a problem. I wish I had knew the solution to the problem of election by litigation. But to think that we would have nonpartisan administration of election law, I just don't think is realistic, unless it's David Norcross and I to get to select all these nonpartisan people, then we'd be assured that they would be. But I doubt if a few other people would agree. I just don't think there is such an animal. And even though occasionally it's seen in the backwoods, you know, in Colorado. But and certainly it's going to be selected by some governmental process in which is being run by, you know, one partisan interest or the other. So I just think it's a rather fanciful approach. I also don't anticipate that there's going to be an agreement by the parties. The McCain campaign proposed that. The response has been deafening, silence on the Obama campaign. I think there are reasons for that. I think the Democrat Party thinks that they have more lawyers and are better deployed and have more resources, and why would they want to give up that, you know, weapon? And I think they're probably right about that. I think it's also a problem of expectation. We're expecting perfection. You know, people have said, well, not, you know, all ballots will be counted, or not all voter registration will be properly entered. Well, hello, this is the government who's doing this. You know, they can't even deliver a letter to the right address. More than
another argument against all mail voting. Yeah. You know?
So, and even if they were bureaucrats, it's human nature. Mistakes are made. We cannot expect perfection, even though it's desirable to want to have every vote cast. What is important about elections is the will of the people is carried through. And of course, in that regard, in April 2001. There was a report of this consortium of media people that actually did recount Florida. All of Florida, you know, using all these different standards, Bush won no matter what the standard was, because they recounted the votes in the whole state, not just in a couple of counties, and then applied whichever standard, lenient or strict, and each time they came up with a Bush victory. But, of course, that hasn't helped in relieving people of the concern that didn't happen. Well, but that's also because of human nature. I mean, there are people that believe that they never lost a fair fight. There are people that believe that Thomas Sowell's vision of the anointed, and I think he was directing this more liberals, frankly, but I see it on my side of the aisle as well, and that is that anybody that opposes me is evil. All right, you know, I mean, I've got a wonderful, kind heart. That's the reason I'm trying to do this. They're opposing me on this, which means they have an evil heart.
You mean they don't?
So, you know, and I see that on both sides of the aisle, and that's a problem. I think also that our elections are more ideological. And frankly, there's a subset of that, which is it's a culture war. Now, when you get into culture, I mean, those are significant differences, you know, that people have. And so I think all of that, you know, kind of leads to the idea that
Unfortunately, we're not going to have an agreement. We're not going to have nonpartisans that can take us out of this mess. But it seems to me we've got to, perhaps in the area of legal standards for litigation, when can they be brought, on which areas of the law or something like that, so that we can not affect the election at just simply as a result of bringing the case. I mean, that happens. You bring the case loses, but you've affected the vote. You've disenfranchised X number of people, and as a result, the election turns. That is a terrible situation.
Let me be clear, Jim. I don't think you're evil. I would prefer that you refer to it as the Democratic Party rather than the Democrat Party. The one thing I would point to, we talked about before, we haven't really got into this ballot design. I mean, ballot design was a huge, you know, reason for the chaos in Florida. You know, that could not be, that could not be resolved through any kind of recount. There are principles of ballot design that can be followed that are, you know, nonpartisan and neutral. The Brennan Center for Justice put out a report about this during the past year, which you can find online. And if we could at least resolve ballot design issues, so that, you know, voters, you know, the same race along the same row, or in electronic voting, you know, one race per page, and where they ask you, you know, are you sure you don't want to vote in this campaign afterwards? And that's one way we can at least reduce some of the litigation and restore some faith in this. You know, let's make sure that the ballots are comprehensible and are clean.
I'll have to take more questions in a second. I guess I have a question going to litigation, whether litigation is a good tool or not. Do any of you perceive a problem with having courts be the final arbiters of whether it was or was not a fair election, much in the same way that courts have become the final arbiters on whether legislation is constitutional, as being a means of passing the buck, that rather than have the political actors take accountability for whether they think it was good and suffer the consequences if it wasn't, it all gets shifted to the courts, and now we blame the Supreme Court, or we blame Florida, rather than blaming the Florida Secretary of State, seeing what happens then.
Well, it is true that in there are some elections by constitutional design, the courts are not the final arbiters, right? And the state constitutions typically provide that the Senate and the House can only judge their own members, and they can treat the whatever happens to the court as completely irrelevant to their decision. Same with the U.S. Congress.
Would greater reliance on that help or hurt? Getting the courts to back away and say, look, there are political means of resolving whether this was or was not a fair election. We're not going to get involved except in, you know, the most egregious of cases, really egregious cases.
Well, that used to be the standard, but there are more egregious cases that are going to be put before them because every close election is going to be litigated and there's going to be more and more allegations of irregularities. I want to put in a word, by the way, for Secretaries of State. I do agree that in a better world we would have nonpartisan Secretaries of State, but let me be very clear how limited their role usually is in a state. Ohio, Jennifer Bruner has lots of critics right now, just as Ken Blackwell did 4 years ago. But they do not decide how many election machines go into a precinct. That is done by a county board that is divided bipartisanly, two Democrats, two Republicans. Kent Blackwell had no more decision-making authority to decide that Athens, Ohio, which is a university town, would have fewer machines than Columbus, Ohio. Jennifer Bruner does not direct the election boards. Those are done at the county level. Now, that may be a flawed system, but in most states, secretaries of state are ministerial jobs, and they have precious little power. They have some interpretive power, and that certainly was exercised in critical moments by Catherine Harris in Florida, which he was criticized for many quarters. I would say leaving it to the political branches in a very close election is not much of an answer either. There's one example where Congress actually got involved in deciding a close presidential election. That was in 1876 between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden. What was their solution? They appointed a commission. They appointed a commission of seven Democrats, seven Republicans, and the lone independent on the Supreme Court. And then at the last minute, the state legislature of Indiana decided to make that Supreme Court justice a United States senator. creating a vacancy which was filled by a partisan figure, in this case a Republican, meaning the commission ended up, contrary to Congress's intent, as 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats. They took separate votes on every disputed electoral vote, of which there were 39. And the vote was 8-7, 39 different times. So there is no perfect system, and there is no generalized rule that you can make. I would say in previous years, the courts have done a pretty good job of handling the most egregious election cases that have been brought before them, like the one in Philadelphia that Mr. Bonin mentioned. I'd like to keep the courts the final arbiter. I just wish there were fewer cases to put before them for arbitration, which is why I'm worried about election litigation.
I'm often reminded of The Simpsons, and especially for something like this. I can't remember what the episode was, but for whatever reason, Homer Simpson had appointed himself as part of a militia, you know, type, police type thing that was governing Springfield. And Bart asked him, you know, if you guys are the police, who will police the police? And Homer thought about it for a second and said, I don't know, Coast Guard? So yeah, I mean, the courts may not be ideal, but compared to the political branches, I mean, my goodness, if we end up with a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College and this thing gets thrown to the House, I don't think that's going to make anybody confident in who our president is on January 20th, 2009. So between the two, yeah, I'll take our votes.
Other questions? Any other questions in the audience? Okay, well then I think that wraps us up. I'd like to thank Wiley Ryan for hosting this conference, and thank you all for coming to this conference. We appreciate it very much, and we hope you learned a lot. Thank you again.